In March 1996, Outside Magazine sent me to Nepal to participate in and write about a guided ascent of Mount Everest. I went as one of 8 clients on an expedition led by a well-known guide from New Zealand named Rob Hall. On May 10th, I arrived on top of the mountain, but the summit came at a terrible cost. Among my 5 teammates who reached the top, 4, including Hall, perished in a rogue storm that blew in without warning while we were still high on the peak. By the time I descended to base camp, 9 climbers from 4 expeditions were dead, and 3 more lives would be lost before the month was out. The expedition left me badly shaken, and the article was difficult to write. Nevertheless, 5 weeks after I returned from Nepal, I delivered a manuscript to Outside, and it was published in the September issue of the magazine. Upon its completion, I attempted to put Everest out of my mind and get on with my life, but that turned out to be impossible. Through a fog of messy emotions, I continued trying to make sense of what had happened up there, and obsessively mulled the circumstances of my companions' deaths. The Outside piece was as accurate as I could make it under the circumstances, but my deadline had been unforgiving, the sequence of events had been frustratingly complex, and the memories of the survivors had been badly distorted by exhaustion, oxygen depletion, and shock. At one point during my research, I asked 3 other people to recount an incident all 4 of us had witnessed high on the mountain, and none of us could agree on such crucial facts as the time, what had been said, or even who had been present. Within days after the Outside article went to press, I discovered that a few of the details I'd reported were in error. Most were minor inaccuracies of the sort that inevitably creep into works of deadline journalism. But one of my blunders was in no sense minor, and had a devastating impact on the friends and family of one of the victims. Only slightly less disconcerting than the article's factual errors was the material that necessarily had to be omitted for lack of space. Mark Bryant, the editor of Outside, and Larry Burke, the publisher, had given me an extraordinary amount of room to tell the story. They ran the piece at 17,000 words, 4 or 5 times as long as a typical magazine feature. Even so, I felt that it was much too abbreviated to do justice to the tragedy. The Everest climb had rocked my life to its core, and it became desperately important for me to record the events in complete detail, unconstrained by a limited number of column inches. This book is the fruit of that compulsion. Several authors and editors I respect counseled me not to write the book as quickly as I did. They urged me to wait 2 or 3 years and put some distance between me and the expedition in order to gain some crucial perspective. Their advice was sound, but in the end I ignored it, mostly because what happened on the mountain was gnawing my guts out. I thought that writing the book might purge Everest from my life. It hasn't, of course. Moreover, I agree that readers are often poorly served when an author writes as an act of catharsis, as I have done here. But I hope something would be gained by spilling my soul in the calamity's immediate aftermath, in the roil and torment of the moment. I wanted my account to have a raw, ruthless sort of honesty that seemed in danger of leaching away with the passage of time and the dissipation of anguish. Some of the same people who warned me against writing hastily had also cautioned me against going to Everest in the first place. There were many, many fine reasons not to go, but attempting to climb Everest is an intrinsically irrational act, a triumph of desire over sensibility. Any person who would seriously consider it is almost by definition beyond the sway of reasoned argument. The plain truth is that I knew better, but went to Everest anyway. And in doing so, I was party to the death of good people, which is something that is apt to remain on my conscience for a very long time. Everest Summit, May 10th, 1996, 29,028 feet. Straddling the top of the world, 1 foot in China and the other in Nepal, I cleared the ice from my oxygen mask, hunched a shoulder against the wind, and stared absently down at the vastness of Tibet. I understood on some dim, detached level that the sweep of earth beneath my feet was a spectacular sight. I'd been fantasizing about this moment and the release of emotion that would accompany it for many months. But now that I was finally here, actually standing on the summit of Mount Everest, I just couldn't summon the energy to care. It was early in the afternoon of May 10th, 1996. I hadn't slept in 57 hours. The only food I'd been able to force down over the preceding